Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Faith Lapidus, Shirley Griffith, and Ray Freeman. But first, this report. All over the world, more and more young people are becoming involved in political activities. In many cases, higher education is related to or even at the center of their activism. The protest movement in Hong Kong was one of the top news stories of 2019. Many of those leading the anti-government protests were young people. Some demonstrators sought shelter from police in university buildings. More recently, demonstrations began spreading across India after an attack on protesters at a university in New Delhi. Some college-age activists have even turned against higher education. This week, students in Chile restarted protests against what they call an unfair university admissions system. And a few years ago, protests against the high cost of study programs hit nearly every university in South Africa. Noella Richard says students in many places have become more politically active in recent years because they are tired of waiting for their voices to be heard.
Richard is Youth Global Program Manager for the United Nations Development Program. She argues that generally speaking, educated young adults in almost every country see the world in similar ways. They are highly informed about major international issues like climate change and want peace, both in their home country and worldwide. She says they also want to change conditions that have led to problems in the past. But young people do not see those in power working towards those goals or representing them in the way they want to be represented, Richard says. So they have chosen to take action and produce change in different ways. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily violent. That doesn't mean necessarily that it is radical, although also, being radical is not necessarily a bad thing. But it's just exploring new forums, she told VOA. In Yemen, a not-for-profit group has worked with young people to fight drug abuse and avoid extremist groups. In Kosovo, a youth-led organization has been developing an employment training program. And in Pakistan, another group has young businessmen working together to prevent religious extremists from taking control of their businesses. In the United States, college students have shown their interest in politics in a more traditional way, voting in elections.
Last September, Tufts University's Institute for Democracy and Higher Education published its latest National Study of Learning, Voting, and Engagement. The study explores the voting records and data for about 10 million American college students. It found that the number of students who voted in U.S. elections more than doubled between 2014 and 2018. Adam Gismondi is Director of Impact at the Institute. He says that college student involvement in political activities dates back hundreds of years. In U.S. politics, there have been periods of heavy student involvement, such as in the 1960s, and low involvement, as in the late 1990s. During the 2018 congressional elections, the overall percentage of Americans voting reached its highest level in over 100 years. Some political observers have linked this with the rise of President Donald Trump as a political figure, with many people wanting to vote for or against him. But Gismondi argues that is not necessarily the case. There's a lot of conversations around national politics, and there's been attention paid to the Trump administration and some of the policies as a result of his election, Gismondi said. But I will say there's some pretty significant data out there that shows that a lot of the activism that we're seeing is issue-based. It's not necessarily party-based.
Many of the biggest issues of the day are ones that college-educated Americans have strong opinions on, says Gismondi. These include gun control, immigration reform, and the rising costs of health care and higher education. But another reason political activism among young people has risen is U.S. colleges and universities themselves, says Clarissa Unger. She is director of civic engagement for Young Invincibles, a nonprofit group that supports youth political involvement. Unger suggests that many schools have made efforts to increase student political involvement. They take steps to ensure students stay informed about issues. Some provide resources that inform students how to register to vote and offer voting centers on school grounds. Unger and Gismondi agree that as a result, many students are not just becoming involved in national political campaigns. They are also voting, and sometimes even competing locally as candidates for elected positions. And, Unger notes, leaders who ignore the interests of the younger generation risk losing their power. At the end of the day, young people want authentic leaders, she said. They don't want to hear politicians saying what they think they want to hear. They want to be heard, and they want authentic leaders who are taking them seriously, taking their concerns seriously. Noella Richard adds, it is important that political involvement not just be limited to the college educated. There are many poor and uneducated young people around the world who do not just deserve an equal voice, she says. They possess valuable knowledge, skills, and opinions, all things leaders must consider when making any decisions about the future. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, it's time for Words and Their Stories, a weekly program from VOA Learning English. English expressions come from a number of different places, and some are quite old. Perhaps one of the oldest expressions is, "Slow and steady wins the race." It comes from a collection of stories known as Aesop's Fables. Aesop is thought to have lived over 2,000 years ago in ancient Greece. Slow and steady wins the race means that if you set a goal for yourself and keep working toward it, you will reach that goal. However, to accomplish that goal, you mustn't waste time on mindless or meaningless things. You must not lose focus. And that brings us to one of Aesop's fables called The Tortoise and the Hare. As you probably know, a hare looks like a large rabbit. It has long ears and runs very fast, much faster than any tortoise. That cannot be debated. As in many fables, the animals are given human personality traits. The hare has a loud, bragging personality and seems overconfident. Tortoise is focused. In The Tortoise and the Hare, these two animals race each other. But now that we know they also have human personalities, what will happen? Let's find out. Here is the Learning English version of The Tortoise and the Hare. One day, Tortoise was walking through the woods. She had business to take care of. So she walked through the forest with her usual determination. When Tortoise passed by Hare, he was standing against a fence post. She simply nodded her head and walked on, very slowly.
Hey, Tortoise, where are you going?
I have some important business to take care of.
Hare found this very funny. He did not want to waste the chance to make fun of Tortoise for being so slow.
If it's so important, why don't you hurry? You'll never get anything done walking like that.
Like what?
Slowly, you fool.
Tortoise lifted her head slowly and answered,
I will take care of my business, and I will get it done sooner than you think.
Yeah, I doubt that. Look at your slow feet. They are no match for my fast feet. Watch me run.
Hare ran around and around in circles. He was indeed very fast.
See? I told you I was fast.
Yes, you are very fast. And you are very confident in your speed. I have an idea. Why don't we run a race?
A race? Between me and you?
The idea of running a race with Tortoise was so funny to Hare that he laughed and laughed. But finally, he agreed. He wanted to embarrass Tortoise for even having the nerve to challenge him.
You have some nerve challenging me. Sure, I'll race you.
Great. We will meet back here tomorrow at this time. Don't be late.
Now Fox was standing nearby and heard everything. She agreed to be the judge. So the next day, Fox marked the distance for the race and started the runners off with her famous whistle. Fox was well known among all the woodland creatures for having the best whistle.
Tortoise, Hare, you will start the race on my whistle. On your mark. Get set.
And off they went. After only a short time, Hare was very far in front of Tortoise. Now Hare, being a petty animal, did not just want to win. He wanted the tortoise to feel foolish. So he started running backwards and yelled insults at her.
You are so far behind me. You look really small. How does it feel to be a loser?
Then Hare ran even further ahead of Tortoise. As he ran, he said to himself,
How dare that tortoise think she can beat me? I'm one of the fastest animals in these woods. You know, I'm not just going to beat her. I'm going to teach her a lesson.
So he stopped. He was going to wait until Tortoise caught up with him and then tease her some more. Hare said,
I'll just stay here under this tree and rest a bit. I'm so fast that I'll be able to beat Tortoise and take a nap.
Tortoise just kept going, slowly but steadily. She said to herself,
I am just going to keep my eyes on the prize. Slow and steady. Onward I go.
After some time passed, Tortoise came to where Hare was sleeping. Hare slept on peacefully as Tortoise passed by him quietly. When Hare finally awoke, Tortoise was near the finish line. Seeing his mistake, he now ran as fast as he could. But he could not catch her in time, and Tortoise won the race. So what is the lesson from this fable? Sometimes in life, the person who succeeds is not the one who is the ablest, but the one who is the most focused and determined. Also, if you waste your time bragging and showing off, as the hare did, you might not reach your goals. And that brings us to the end of this program. But join us again next week for another Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the presidential election of 1888, one issue that played a major part was tariffs. At that time, import taxes were high on many products. The high tariffs protected American goods from competing with lower-priced foreign imports. The tariffs protected millions of jobs in American industry. Not everyone, however, supported high tariffs. The President of the United States, Grover Cleveland, decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get the tariffs reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of business people. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. Shirley Griffith and Ray Freeman tell about the presidential election of 1888.
President Cleveland believed that high tariffs hurt more Americans than they protected. High tariffs, he said, led to high prices on all products. He also opposed high tariffs because they brought in more money than the government needed. The extra money was kept in the public treasury, and this, Cleveland believed, slowed the American economy. The president's Democratic Party united to support his policy of lowering tariffs. When the party held its presidential nominating convention in 1888, delegates quickly renominated Cleveland.
At the Republican Party convention, delegates were expected to nominate Senator James Blaine. Blaine had been the party's candidate 4 years earlier. He had lost to Cleveland in a very close election. Senator Blaine publicly criticized the president's policy on tariffs. He said he looked forward to a full debate on the issue. Republicans thought this meant that Blaine wanted to be nominated for president again. They told him he was sure to win. They said it would be such an easy victory that he would not have to campaign.
In fact, Blaine did not want the nomination. He asked that his name not be put before the convention. he met with reporters to talk about his decision. He said, "A man who has once been the candidate of his party and defeated owes it to his party not to be a candidate again." Many Republicans refused to accept Blaine's decision. They felt that if Blaine were nominated, he would run. Blaine replied, "If the presidential nomination is offered to me, I could not and would not accept it." That was final. Blaine's supporters had to find someone else to nominate for president.
Fourteen men declared themselves to be candidates for the Republican nomination. A leading candidate was Senator John Sherman of Ohio. Another was former Senator Benjamin Harrison of Indiana. Convention delegates voted several times. No man received enough votes to win the nomination. Then a message came from James Blaine. It said, "Nominate Harrison." On the eighth vote, the delegates did. Benjamin Harrison was the grandson of the ninth president of the United States, William Henry Harrison. Benjamin was a lawyer. He had been a general in the Union Army during America's Civil War of the 1860s.
After nominating Harrison, the Republicans approved a strong policy statement on the tariff question. The statement said, "We fully support the American system of protection. President Cleveland and his party serve the interests of Europe. We would support the interests of America. We would see all other taxes ended before we surrender any part of the protective tariff system."
Benjamin Harrison's campaign was well organized. His campaign workers went to businessmen who had become rich because of high protective tariffs. They asked for support, and the businessmen gave millions of dollars to the campaign. The businessmen also put pressure on the people who worked for them. They warned workers that if Cleveland were reelected, there might be no more jobs. Republican Party leaders took an active part in the campaign of 1888. They made speeches and led parades across the country. The party also printed millions of pamphlets that warned against what it called Cleveland's free trade policies.
Grover Cleveland's campaign was not well organized. It started slowly. It did not raise much money. No effort was made to answer Republican attacks on the tariff issue. And the president himself refused to campaign. He said he had more important things to do. The Democrats also failed to stop the Republicans from buying votes on Election Day. In Indiana, for example, men were paid $15 to vote for the Republican candidate. The Democrats bought votes too, but they had less money to spend than the Republicans. When the popular votes were counted, Cleveland had about 100,000 more than Harrison. But Harrison had more electoral votes. He won the election.
Grover Cleveland had mixed feelings about his defeat. He wanted to win because he believed his policies were best for the country. He said he was not sorry that he had made tariffs the major issue in the campaign. "I do not regret it," he said. "It is better to be defeated battling for an honest idea than to win by a cowardly trick." When President Cleveland and his wife left the White House, Mrs. Cleveland said goodbye to the servants. She told one of them, I want you to take good care of all the furniture and other things in the house. I want to find everything the same when we come back 4 years from now.
The new president, Benjamin Harrison, had big political debts to repay. He understood this when he began organizing his administration. When I came to power, Harrison said, I found that my party's leaders had taken all the power for themselves. I could not name my own cabinet. They had sold every cabinet position to pay for the election.
The position of Secretary of State went to James Blaine, who had refused his party's requests to run for president. Blaine had served as Secretary of State under Presidents James Garfield and Chester Arthur. The position of Postmaster General went to John Wanamaker. Wanamaker had raised most of the money for Harrison's campaign. He had given $50,000 of his own money. He planned to repay party supporters with jobs in the post office department.
During the campaign, Harrison had promised to enforce the civil service law that protected the job rights of government workers. He promised that workers would be removed only in the interests of better government. Wanamaker and other party leaders criticized Harrison. They said they could not build a strong party organization without promising government jobs to voters. So President Harrison suspended the civil service laws that protected postal workers. Within a year, 30,000 Democrats were removed from the department. Their jobs went to Republicans. The president then announced that the post office would once again be protected by the civil service laws.
Former President Cleveland had been troubled by the extra money in the federal treasury. This was tax money the government collected but did not use. Most of the extra money came from high protective tariffs on imported products. Cleveland wanted to reduce the surplus by reducing the tariffs. President Harrison decided to reduce the surplus too, but he would do it by increasing government spending, not by cutting taxes. Congress agreed. It became the first Congress to spend $1,000 million.
Much of the money was spent on payments to men who had fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. These payments cost the government more than $100 million a year. Congress also approved millions of dollars for government projects in the home states of important congressmen. This was called pork barrel spending. It paid for new roads, bridges, and government buildings, for almost anything the congressman wanted. Congress reduced the surplus even more by approving money to build coastal defenses and to buy warships for the Navy.
The American Congress passed several historic pieces of legislation during Benjamin Harrison's administration.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.